So you can go ahead and open up your Bibles to Ruth chapter 4, and then if you have a bulletin, in the bulletin is a teaching sheet to follow along with some of the main points of the message. So we're at the last chapter of Ruth, and by the end of this chapter, we're going to see how everything falls into place. Now, have any of you ever been in that position where you wake up in the morning and you realize that possibly by the end of the day, your life could be dramatically different one way or the other? Maybe it's like a job interview that you go to, and you know if you get that job, your life is going in a particular direction. Or maybe it's the big day where you think that that guy is going to propose to you, and you're all excited, or whatever it may be, but there is this big moment ahead for that day. And that's where we're at in Ruth chapter 4. Boaz is at really a fork in the road, but it's beyond his control. And now he's just waiting to see what will happen here. Will he be the one to marry Ruth, or will it be the other guy that gets her? So to review now, before we start going through our passage this morning, in Ruth chapter 1, there was a famine. And the famine led this one family, Naomi, her husband, two sons, to leave Bethlehem to go to Moab. It's a bad decision. The dad dies, the kids die, and Naomi is left with two daughters-in-law. One of them goes back home, but Ruth clings to the mother-in-law, Naomi, and the two of them head back to Bethlehem after 10 or so years in Moab. They get in there, it's a big stir. They're poor, destitute. Naomi's a pretty bitter, empty woman at that point. In chapter 2, Ruth tries to make a living and tries to survive and goes to the field, and she meets Boaz. And Boaz is very friendly to her, gives things to her. And this gives Naomi an idea in chapter 3 to go and Ruth for her to propose to Boaz. So in chapter 3, we have a strange proposal. I won't go into it. If you missed it, go online and watch last week's sermon. It's an interesting proposal, to say the least. And so at the end of chapter 3 now, Ruth has proposed, but Boaz said, yes, basically he said, I want to marry you, but there's another guy that has first dibs on you, so I need to go and talk to him. And we were left at that point last week in chapter 3 saying, all right, well, what's going to happen? And I hope none of you read ahead. No, you can read ahead anytime. And so we now know that in this chapter, we're going to find out who Ruth will end up with. Before we go any further, though, in the chapter, we need to talk about what a kinsman redeemer is, a kinsman redeemer, because it's going to come up multiple times throughout this chapter. A kinsman redeemer comes from Leviticus chapter 25, verses 23 through 34. You can write that down and read it later. I won't read it today, but Leviticus chapter 25, starting verse 23. And what it does, it provides for families who become so poor that they're about to lose their land, or for widows who have lost their husband and have no sons, the nearest relative must step in and help those people. And so they are the kinsman redeemer. And that is the position that Naomi and Ruth are in this situation, that Naomi, that Ruth, through Naomi, needs a kinsman redeemer in order to survive in this ancient land, because women at that time could not just go and do things on their own. They needed that husband to protect them and to provide for them. And so the kinsman redeemer is going to come up multiple times. Let's go ahead and look at Ruth chapter 4, verse 1. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. Now that word behold there in the ESV points to surprise. Essentially it's saying, it's like, and suddenly the guy shows up. Now the gate, that area is a popular area. It was common for people to come in and out of that area of town. But what are the odds of Boaz showing up and then just right away, this dude just walks by? Behold, there he is. And as I talked about in chapter 2, what seemed like a surprise to Boaz was not a surprise to God, because when we follow God, God is working behind the scenes to orchestrate these things that seem like coincidences to us, but are not a coincidence to God. And so then, let's look at the rest of verse 1. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." And so they sat down. Now that word there, friend, is a nice translation, but it's not completely accurate in the ESV. If you look at the Hebrew, the literal translation is so-and-so. So-and-so, it's like an anonymous name for someone. He's basically, his name is Mr. So-and-so. We don't know his real name, and we're never given it. And so from this point forward, I will refer to him as Mr. So-and-so, because that is a more literal translation there. And I think it's pretty funny. And so the first redeemer, the one that has dibs on Ruth, Mr. So-and-so, shows up. Boaz says, "Hey, sit down with me. We need to talk some business." And in that time, to talk business, you had to bring some other guys around. So he has the 10 elders come and sit down with him. And that's what makes it more of like a legal proceeding. It would be like going to court, and you have the judge there, and you have everybody. It's all, everything's official. Or, you know, when you bought the house, you had the notary sign all your paperwork. That's what those 10 elders there are for. And so this, now we're getting to the point that we're waiting for. This is the moment where things are going to begin to happen. What will happen to Boaz and what will happen to Ruth? Verse 3. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. And if you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know. For there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, Mr. So-and-so said, "I will redeem it. I will redeem it." Now, what Boaz does here is interesting, because Mr. So-and-so, I'm assuming, knows that he's the redeemer. I think he knows that he's the redeemer, but at this point, he has done nothing to help out Naomi or Ruth. So instead of Boaz saying, "Hey, you're going to take Ruth or not? Come on." He goes a different route by asking Mr. So-and-so about the land. Now, we don't know from the story what this land is, other than it is part of her family, of Naomi's family. And so as I studied and looked up this, most likely what he's referring to is that when Naomi and her husband left Bethlehem years prior, they sold the land, or sold the rights to the land, for a certain period of time, sort of like what we would know as a lease. They sort of leased it out, and then they left, and with whatever payment they received from a time of famine. And the guy has that land for a certain period of time. And most likely now, it's been 10, 11, 12 years. And so most likely that time period is up. And Boaz is negotiating a new lease for that land. And he's saying, "Hey, you have first dibs to it, and so do you want it?" And this is interesting, though, because here's my theory. You won't find this in any commentary. This comes straight from Island Pond. So if you hear it anywhere else, you'll know it came here first. I think that Mr. So-and-so, as the nearest relative, currently has the land, is the one currently leasing the land. And I think that he has what he wants right now. He has the land, and he's probably hoping that, you know, Naomi, Ruth will just sort of just go off, and that he can end up with the land himself. He doesn't want the baggage of a mother-in-law or of a new wife to come in and take over that. So he's very quiet and doing nothing. And Boaz now is sort of exposing this. Say, he's saying, "All right, it's coming up for release. Do you want it or not?" So he said, yeah, I want the land. But Boaz now is going to bring up something else to sort of turn the tables a little bit. And I said a moment ago, that was the moment of truth. Right now here is the moment of truth. Verse 5. And then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. You notice how he's being honest here, but he's also being a little shrewd. Naomi, he's not saying, hey, Naomi's awesome, or Ruth is awesome. No, he's saying Ruth, the foreigner, who's a widow, who's now going to be carrying on, not your line, but her dead husband's line. Do you want her? That one. You want that one with a lot of baggage there. And verse 6, then the Redeemer, Mr. So-and-so, said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So there we have it. In two sentences, Ruth's fate has been determined. The man wants the land, but he doesn't want the woman. And so if he marries Ruth, he would end up with the land, but then down the road, he would have to then give the land back to Ruth and his children. And he's saying, no, that would mess up my inheritance. I don't want it. I want the land for myself, but I don't want to deal with all that other stuff. That made me think, that this isn't really a main point of the message, but made me think, men, are you more like Boaz or are you more like Mr. So-and-so? Mr. So-and-so, in this passage we can see, only cares about what he can get out of things. If it doesn't benefit him, he wanted nothing to do with it. Boaz, on the other hand, was willing to put the needs of others in front of himself. And as we'll see as we continue along, Boaz gives us a powerful picture of what it means to be a redeemer. Of what it means to be a redeemer. So are you more like Boaz or are you more like Mr. So-and-so? I'll come back to this a little bit later on. And so the deed's been done. Boaz ends up with Ruth. Let's walk through the next few verses as we see sort of the ancient customs of how deals are solidified and made permanent at that point. Verse 7, now this was the custom in the former times of Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. And then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. And then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together build up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah. It gets worse as we get further along here. But Ephrathah, and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, and whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of your offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. And so Mr. So-and-so moves off, and Boaz gets the woman. And the elders bless Boaz, saying, yes, yes, may you be blessed. And they celebrate what happens. And this leads me to something that sort of impacted me as I was thinking about this part of the passage this week. And that's the power of community. The power of community. I just want you to think for a minute. This story, and particularly this chapter, and particularly these few verses, show us what the power of community can be. We see here, the elders go and gather together with Boaz. Now, they gathered together for legal reasons to testify and to look at what's going on. But we get to the end there, and in that end part where they're blessing him, and they say all these things in verse 11 and 12, like, then all the people were at the gate, and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman. And say, may you act worthily. May your house be like, and so on. That's not legal stuff. That's just the men surrounding him and saying, yes, yes. That's the community there. That's the power of the community. No, that was thousands of years ago, wasn't it? But I want to say that things have not changed in this day and age as well. Community can still be powerful. Community can still be a great benefit to us today. And all of us need community. All of us need people who will surround us and celebrate with us and cry with us and encourage us and challenge us and hold us accountable. And when we do not have those people, we are missing out on an important part of the Christian life. One description that's given in the Bible of what the church is a body. Now, when we think of a body, what do we think of? We think of parts that are intact. If I were to bring someone up here and just maybe grab his hand and start flopping his hand around, you might think I'm weird by doing that. But you wouldn't think anything weird of what you saw here, because hands attached to body parts are very normal, aren't they? But what if I went over here and I pulled out a severed hand and then I started flopping that around? Bill would be like, not in my last few weeks, blood everywhere. Come on, how am I going to clean that up, Kyle? Flopping around. You would think that was weird. Why? Because hands are not supposed to be severed from the body. And likewise, the church is described as a body. And we are not meant to be severed and off in our individual little parts. We are not severed parts. We are whole. We are a body. And that is the benefit, that is the power of community right there. Listen to Hebrews chapter 10. Verses 24 and 25, it says, and let us consider how to stir one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some. If you remember when we were studying through Hebrews, the context there was that there were people falling away. There were people walking away from Christ. And the author's saying, hey, let's encourage each other. Let's stick together. And those who are walking away or falling away or not meeting, come back to the community. Because in the community, we can find encouragement. We can find accountability. We can find help. Now, I'm no military expert here, but I watch a lot of movies. So when I see the SWAT teams go into the different places, I always see them go in groups. You know, one's looking that way, one's looking that way and that way. They're all sort of keeping an eye here in different parts. I could be totally off here, but that's what I see in the shows. But I think that is what a picture of the church is as well. That is what we should be doing. As we're walking together. One person's looking forward. And the others are looking out for the others. And one person's looking in the back. And we're all sort of protecting each other. You know, we should change our name to Island Pond SWAT Church. That would be good. Our men's discipleship group meets a couple times a month on Wednesday evenings. And a couple of weeks ago, one of the guys said at the end of the group, he said, you know, I did not feel like coming tonight. I was not in a good mood. I was not in a good place. But I am so thankful I did, because I just feel so encouraged and so built up. I'm just so thankful I came tonight. Why did he say that? Is it because he saw, you know, my happy face? Because he likes my jokes? No. It's the power of community. that as we surround each other and protect each other and celebrate with each other and really challenge each other as well, that in those moments, that's the power that's in that. So I want to encourage each of you here that if you're not part of a community here in this church, you may say, I come here on a Sunday morning, so I'm part of the church community. Well, you know, even with a church, we're not a big church, but even with 100 plus people, it's easy to sort of slip in and slip out if you want to. And so look for group opportunities here in the church to start to get to know people and start to be more involved. And we have lots of them for a church our size. I count. We have, I think, 10 different groups meeting on a regular basis. We have the women meeting twice a week on, Thursday morning, Thursday evening. We have the retired men meeting. It is 10 a.m., right? Did I write that down? Okay, 10 a.m. We have the young men meeting Wednesday evening, certain Wednesday evenings at 7:30. We have small group on Sunday at 5:30, and then we should be starting another one up in the next month or so on Monday evenings in this area. Plus, we have Sunday school, 9 a.m. We have 3 different Sunday school groups throughout the church here. All of these are ways that you can get involved in the community here. And, you know, you just come once, you know, it'll benefit you a little bit. But you come back and get to know the people and let them encourage you. And you encourage others and let them challenge you. And you challenge others. Then you will find the power of community, as Boaz noticed there. And so the men have celebrated with Boaz, and that essentially is the end of the main part of the story in Ruth. That's, the climax of it. Everything after now is going to be the different resolutions of what is going to take place, the resolutions. So we're going to see 3 important resolutions as we work our way through here. And so let's look at verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went in to her. I was like, come on, writer, can you be any more descript here? And the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. So here we have the first resolution. Ruth and Boaz marry, and she gets pregnant right away. She gets pregnant right away. So Ruth, the foreigner widower, is now a happy mom. That's resolution number 1. Now, I find it interesting here in this just one little verse that it says that the Lord gave her conception. You think about it. She was married for 10 plus years prior to this to another person, and she was not able to have kids during that entire time. But the moment her and Boaz hook up and get married, and she gets pregnant right away, the Lord gave her conception. Now, hear me carefully here. We often can't understand God's ways in many different situations. So I don't understand why God allows some people to have children and others to not have children. But make no mistake that children are conceived at the giving of the Lord. At the giving of the Lord. Some kids are planned by us, and others are not. But all are given by the Lord. And I was thinking about this week, that may we treat every child in the womb as such. Every child as one that is given by the Lord, whether convenient or not. Whether healthy or not, whether planned or not, they are given and special by the Lord. Verse 14. And then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age and your daughter-in-law, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him." And then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. Here's resolution number 2. Naomi, who walked in the town empty just chapters before is now full again. She's now full again. Think about this. She walked in just in the end of chapter one with nothing. She said, "I am empty." She was bitter. She was angry at God. And yet just a few chapters later, there are women surrounding her, by the way, power of community right there. There are women surrounding her. And when they were amazed at her destituteness in chapter one, they are now amazed at her blessedness or fullness in chapter four. Naomi had no hope for the future in chapter one, chapter two, and really chapter three as well. But now she has everything she needs. And so while the story focuses here on Naomi, the same could be said about Ruth as well. She walked in with nothing, but now she is full again. Thinking about now the last resolution here, we'll look at verse 17 in a moment. But this is really a surprise part of the story. And I like how one pastor, David Platt, described this last part of the chapter. If any of you have watched those movies by M. Night Shyamalan, where, you know, like The Sixth Sense, this is years ago now, where there's something that happens at the end of the movie that changes everything about how you think about the entire movie. Like in The Sixth Sense, you get to the end, and not only do you then not want to be in the dark for the rest of the year, or at least am I the only one here, but you realize that, oh, he was dead the entire time, and then you're like, oh, and just the whole movie has a different meaning now because of the ending. And this is what happens in Ruth now. We have one of those moments. I have no doubt that M. Night Shyamalan copied some of his changes right from Ruth chapter 4 here. Look at verse 17. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." And they named him Obed. And he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. David, King David. Now, verse 18, now these are generations, and he goes on through the different names that are hard to pronounce. In verse 22, Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. And so Ruth, the foreigner, the destitute one, is now having a child named with Boaz named Obed. Obed is the father of Jesse, and Jesse is the father of the King David, of King David in the Old Testament. The great writer of the Psalms, the great king of the Old Testament. Now, the cool part is, not only is it cool that he's a king, but if you turn to Matthew chapter 1, I won't read it, but Matthew chapter 1's the section with the long genealogy, you know, the one that you usually skip as you go through your reading plans, and then you get to later on to the narrative, and then you start reading. But in that narrative, in chapter 1, verse 5, we see that there's the names of Boaz, of Ruth, and Oab, of Obed. But if you follow that genealogy down, you see that not only is Obed the father of Jesse and Jesse the father of David, but you continue down the line, we see that Ruth is the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus himself. Jesus himself. And this is resolution number 3. We thought we were reading a love story, weren't we? But what we're reading actually is a rescue story. The rescue story. The story of God working out his redemption plan for us. This is not just a story about Boaz and Ruth falling in love and living happily ever after. This is ultimately a story of God's love for us. Of God's love for us. That years prior, hundreds of years prior, he was working a way for these two crazy people to end up together, to years later then to be in the line of Jesus Christ himself. This leads me to the second big application of this story, and it's God's faithfulness. God's faithfulness. You know, this was a short book, but a lot happened here. Naomi and Ruth went from being widows and scavenging to really being full and rich. They went from hopeless to being full of hope. Yet by the end, everything that they lost was restored. Their two biggest problems were food and a husband. A husband would be a way of providing for them. And by the end, they got both of those. God was good to them. God was faithful to them. But the beauty of this is that he's not just faithful to Ruth. He's not just faithful to Boaz. He's faithful to us as well. I like how one commentary put it. Said, God's hesed restored Naomi. That's God's kindness, God's love. But it also restores us. And with Naomi, sometimes the process seems slow from a human standpoint, but gradually and indefinitely, God acts to bring us back. God is sovereignly in control, whether in life or in death. Let me ask you, do you believe that? Do you believe that God is in control? And do you believe that God is faithful? Because if you do, that will direct how you live your life versus if you do not believe that, you'll live your life a different way. All of us go through times in our life where it seems like God is not there. Boaz, Ruth, Naomi, there were times when it seemed like God was not there. But as we worked our way through the story, we see God was there every step of the way. Did they have a perfect life? No. But God ultimately was faithful to them. May we hold fast to that God is faithful. Last point of application here is kinsman redeemer. The whole idea of kinsman redeemer I want to talk about and close with. The story of Ruth gives us a picture of what a kinsman redeemer is. I already talked about what it is, but let me define it again, that it's a redeemer rescues a person or a family out of destitution, out of slavery, or to carry on the family line. The practice was set up in the Old Testament, but like many aspects of the Old Testament, it gives us really, it's not just the law. The law is not just there for law's sake. The law is there to give us all a picture of what Jesus will do for us or has done for us. The whole idea of a kinsman redeemer, yeah, it's nice in Ruth, but it is pointing to something far greater for all of us. You see, just as Ruth and Naomi were destitute and without any earthly hope, we are all destitute without any spiritual hope on our own. Romans 3:23 says that we've all sinned. All of us. None of us are perfect. All of us have messed up. And Romans 6:23 says that the wages of sin is death. And so because of our sin, which all of us have committed, spiritually we are now headed for death, for spiritual death. But God has richly and lavishly poured out his love for us on us. Look at Ephesians chapter 1. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to his riches of his grace, according to the riches of his grace, which he lavished upon us in all wisdom and insight. So in him we have redemption. He's redeemed us according to the riches of his grace. Doesn't that just, some of that wording there remind us of what Boaz did for Ruth? But this is a picture of what, or this is saying what Christ has done for us. Just like Boaz showed unnecessary kindness to Ruth, Jesus Christ has shown unnecessary kindness to us. He became our kinsman redeemer. So I want to challenge you today to respond to him as the kinsman redeemer. First of all, accept it. Accept his offer as kinsman redeemer. He has amazing grace that he offers, but you must accept it. What did Ruth have to do in this story? to get married. It wasn't the greatest plan, but in our story, we see that Ruth went to Boaz and proposed marriage in that same way. We must then accept what Christ is offering. But first, second, we need to pass it on. We've been given this amazing grace. We've been given this love here. And now this is news that everyone should hear, not just here in this room, but we should take it out into the community and share it with other people. Let's not just be like, oh yeah, I got some great news here. Now I'm going to keep to myself. But this is important news for people to hear. That if you truly believe that Christ has saved you, then what you're saying is that Christ must save others as well to get to heaven. To pass on the good news. And then lastly, grow it. Grow it. So Christ has offered you this. You've accepted it. Now grow it in your life. Not the salvation part, but grow in your intimacy with God. Spend time daily in the Word. Spend time memorizing and just reading about the story of Jesus Christ throughout all the scriptures. It looks like it's different books. Parts of it can be a little confusing, but all of it has one theme. And we've seen it in Ruth here, and that's Jesus Christ's love for us and coming to save us. And you will not grow unless you spend daily time in this Word. Let's go ahead and pray.